dinosaurs went to hell. Hell, 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 it's a wonderful place. It's a place of fire and brimstone. Politicians, you are going to hell. Magic Jesus apparitions send you to hell. Buddhist monks without God, you are going to hell. Those of you dissecting frogs, you are going to hell. Hell, 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 it's a wonderful place. It's a place of fire and brimstone. I need a beer. That was pretty good. Okay. All you Catholics wearing condoms, you are going to hell. All us baddies eating bonbons, we are going to hell. Unbaptized babies learn to limbo, purgatory's hell. And your religion is a gamble, and you are going to hell. Hell, 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 it's a wonderful place. It's a place of fire and brimstone.
Check this shit out. It's gonna change your life.
The world's with a man who thought that it'd be all the pages of the Bible, he can kill most anything. In 1913, he died of a stroke when he tried to eat the book of Kings. Eat the book of Kings. Eat the book of Kings.
Welcome to the motherfucking Mindcore podcast. This is Psychonaut, and here I am with Diana. And today we had the pleasure of interviewing science fiction author Paul DeFilippo, who Diana was really the one who discovered this author for both of us. And would you mind telling us a little bit about him?
Paul DeFilippo is one of my favorite authors. He's because he writes really evocative prose, and he has really witty and beautiful metaphors, and his stories are kind of outlandish and entertaining. And I just think the language of his books is so lovely that that it just really merits a read, no matter if you like the subject matter or not, I think. Because especially, you know, he writes in genres and stuff that people understandably might be hesitant about. Like, I'm going to give you a phrase, and I want you to tell me what immediately comes to your mind. Science fiction erotica.
Well, now that I've read a little Paul DeFilippo, I couldn't give you an honest answer about that, but I know that originally when you were first telling me about science fiction erotica, I did picture that they would have to be some kind of strange alien version of sex, but DeFilippo exceeds my expectations.
Well, see, when I hear the phrase sci-fi erotica, I think about, like, Seven of Nine and, like, a porno based on Battlestar Galactica. It doesn't seem very intellectual or anything any girl would ever like in a million years. But actually, he pulls it off, and he makes it badass and cool. He takes something that shouldn't work and absolutely makes it work.
I think the fact that he really pushes the envelope on what on the imagination is part of what makes it so good. Like for example, the fact that the character is in A Mouthful of Tongues, which is the book that you recommended to me, that she is an amorphous being that's constantly changing her shape, and how he gets into the sublime aspects of that, and even the psychology of that, is really, really intense.
He writes in a gripping style, which actually had this conversation with somebody else earlier this week. Like, is it better to write a gripping story or a story that might not be as immediately accessible but is more, like, telling the truth or is more important or whatever? And I think that's a bullshit dichotomy. I think you should write a gripping story that is important and has something to say. So to speak. You know, I don't, those are mutually exclusive ideas. So I think Paul DiFilippo is the reason I believe that, because he does write gripping stories that are rich with meaning, and they are accessible to, like, a casual reader.
Could you tell us a little bit about the steampunk trilogy?
The steampunk trilogy is really fun. It's a three-part novel, and to be honest, I've only read the first two. But it was written in 1995, so well before the current internet formation of steampunk. And my favorite story so far that I've read is a story called Victoria. And it's about a newt woman, but it's steampunk, like every stereotypical fashion that you see now. And it's kind of brilliant. Really, really a fun read. And, of course, Paul DiFilippo, like we said, doesn't mind writing really crazy erotica type stuff. And so there's elements of that in there as well. If you can imagine an erotica, steampunk, newt woman being interesting at all, it really, truly is.
What could you expand? What does newt woman mean?
It means a woman that's made out of a newt. Like an aquatic lizardy amphibian thing.
Oh, that does sound cool.
Yeah, but she's life size and is like close enough to looking like a real woman that she casts like a decoy, another woman. But she's a she eats flies.
Oh, she eats flies and everything?
Yeah.
Well, so let's take this out a little further before we introduce the interview. So, you know, why should we read sci-fi? Like, you and I kind of read sci-fi by default, but maybe we have some listeners that are not, like, really into it yet. What's cool about sci-fi at all? Why would someone care about sci-fi enough to even discover sci-fi erotica?
Well, if you want to be my friend, you have to like sci-fi. Don't you agree?
I think that's a pretty good standard for being my friend, yes.
Oh, no, like, but honestly, science fiction is good, can be really good, I should say. I think there's a lot of really terrible science fiction, but the good science fiction, it manages to be gripping and innovative and entertaining and also somewhat realistic or predicts something.
I think that's the aspect that's the most intriguing to me, is the fact that science fiction can be prescient.
Yeah, like Arthur C. Clarke wrote an article that led to the creation of satellites.
Yeah, precisely, that sort of thing. But even, you know, when I think about that kind of thing in the back of my mind, and then I read someone like Paul DiFilippo talking about, like, stem cell erotica... I like the fact that it has that prescient potential behind the writing.
Yeah, even if it's not, like, overtly realistic, it certainly speaks to something that is, you know? It's a hyperbole of what is possible. But even at its most, like, conservative estimate, stem cells are an exciting frontier, you know? So any advancement that can be made with stem cells is exciting.
Sure, absolutely.
I think, and, you know, the fact that it's getting held back is so tragic, you know, at least in my opinion. And I do understand, like, the opposition against it insofar as, like, why are you going to tamper with nature? But I don't get the spunk is human life.
No, people who are opposed to stem cell research for religious reasons definitely have a very primitive and misinformed grasp of the issue to begin with. They don't understand, like, that is basically what they're saying. That it's the equivalent of saying that sperm is the same as a human life.
And that is what's so ironic about mouthful of tongues, is because in a mouthful of tongues, the spunk does become human life, but it's like a very morphed and perverted and disgusting form of human life.
Yeah, I think that it does reach kind of a deeper kind of analysis, like a naturalist analysis of, like, what does life mean? What does birth mean? What is even, like, these human, like, bodily functions that I go throughout my life with mean? And I feel like these kind of things are usually untapped in literature.
Yeah, I think it's a brave thing to tackle, especially a brave thing to tackle in the negative.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, you know, we are all susceptible to change. We are all susceptible to chaos. You know, there are no guarantees. And that's kind of what you get from a mouthful of tongues, I think.
It's kind of like, to me, even, it's as, I would go as far as to say this kind of writing is what makes science really interesting to the average person. Like, if you're in, you know, there's basically two kinds of ways to think about science. You can be a scientist, and where you're, like, just obsessed with it, and you make it your number one muse and everything you care about. Or you can be a regular person who's fucking having to deal with just existing as a human being, paying the bills, organizing their priorities. Not everybody can be a fucking research scientist. And then why is this kind of stuff interesting? Well, you know, when you read someone like Paul DeFilippo, who takes, like, basic human functions, basic human, like, what is, like, basic biological concepts that are part of our bodies, that are part of our lives, why should we care about them? Why should they be stimulating? And he really delivers.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the other thing is that, in addition to being, like, so cool on this deeper level or whatever, is that the language is beautiful. It's a pleasing read.
Sure.
And, yeah, like, the metaphors in the book are, like, I don't know, like, they're almost whimsical, but that kind of, like, denies it some of its coolness to say it's whimsical. Because it's cool, like, it's badass, but at the same time you're like, oh, that was a nice metaphor. Or at least it was that way for me.
No, it's definitely an enriching kind of prose. It's not lowballing anything.
Yeah, and it's memorable, and it's lovely, and it's short.
Concise.
Well, yeah. Dude, that is my hallmark. If you can accomplish all those things and it be short, then you've really made it in my mind.
It's like that Shakespeare quote. We were even talking about it off the air. The brevity is the mother of wit.
Yes.
I think Paul DeFilippo will be pleased with our analysis.
Yeah, he is a motherfucking wizard.
Yeah, that definitely worth checking out, and I think that the listeners will enjoy the interview. And without further ado,
message 23, sent customer 512666666 has sent you a text to landline message. Why did you hang up on me?
I'm gonna get you, 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 I'm gonna get you,
Today we're interviewing Paul DiFilippo, who happens to be one of my favorite authors. And you've written, like, so many different types of things that it's hard to kind of pin you down. Like, you do reviews, you do stories, short stories, fiction, nonfiction, comics. So how would you describe yourself as an author?
Well, let me just thank you guys for having me on the show. It's a pleasure and an honor that you considered me for it. I don't know. It's just I do so many different things just to keep myself amused. I mean, I don't want to fall into a rut. I think it would hinder my own creativity and probably bore people. So I bounce around in a lot of different forms, a lot of different media, and it's hard to. Well, I just my default mode of writing, I think, is kind of snarky humor writing, which I've been doing for ever since I was a teenager in high school, writing for the high school paper. And I say snarky, but I try to be a little more insightful and cosmic in my humor than just, you know, snide japes and poking fun at people. But I do a humor column for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and whenever I'm writing those, they seem to flow very easily and spontaneously, and I tend to think that my other writing is not labored, but it's something I have to consciously shift into when I'm not writing a humor column.
Yeah, my default writing is gothic poetry. But
I like that.
No, I'm just kidding. Well, that was definitely my first writing, and it was not good at all. Okay, so you say you're a humor writer, but actually, like, my favorite story is, like, I wouldn't pin it as funny. I mean, I guess there's funny moments in it. It's actually kind of dark, and it's it's a work of erotica, so it's sexual, obviously. And it's also kind of science fiction-y and magical realism, all that makes sense, kind of all in one package. But I didn't get the funny from you first.
No.
I can read steampunk. Now I can see that.
Sure. Well, that, you know, I do, as I say, I made a conscious decision when I was starting out writing that I would try, you know, a lot of different modes and pursue a lot of different avenues. And so some of the stuff I write is blended, you know, tragicomic, a mix of humor and seriousness, and others is other works are just straight on dark or speculative, or, you know, I try to do unalloyed stories from time to time that just focus very, you know, with a certain intensity on one mode of writing.
I have to make a confession. I actually kind of Facebook stalked you a little bit. And
well,
I saw
that's acceptable. That's standard. It's a mistake.
It was research, so it's okay. It's permissible.
I never say anything on Facebook, though, so you probably didn't get too far.
Well, what I saw, I thought was, I don't know, I loved it. I saw you with H.P. Lovecraft's Tombstone.
Oh, yeah, that's a cool picture with a lot of my buddies, my writing buddies.
Yeah, that was an awesome picture, and it totally made me think of, like, the connections with H.P. Lovecraft, and kind of wondering if that was something that was in your writing, because you guys are both from the same area, or is it not?
That's a totally great question, Diana. Thanks for bringing that up. He's, you know, Lovecraft was a native Rhode Islander, so am I. I've lived in Providence for the past 35 years. I grew up outside of the city, but after college I stayed here. And I don't think you can live in Providence and be a writer and not be sensitive to his influence and heritage. And, you know, I started reading him as a kid. I remember being totally freaked out by At the Mountains of Madness, which I think is still one of his, my opinion remains that it's, you know, probably his best, most focused work, that one story. And he's been an influence for, you know, as long as I've been a reader, actually, almost. And I've made conscious homages to his work in Steampunk Trilogy and elsewhere. So I think he's definitely a major influence. And I'm a big walker. I try to get out, you know, because writing is such a sedentary thing. You have to just break away and try to exercise at certain points of the day. So I'm a big walker. That's my preferred exercise. And as you stroll around Providence, you're inevitably following his footsteps, literally, and seeing, you know, the Shunned House and Charles Dexter Ward's mansion and so forth. So it's a omnipresent experience, I think.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, he was one of the very first guys, especially with, like, short fiction that I got into as a kid. And what I loved about him, yeah, was the atmospheres that he created. They were so scary. And
yes. Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's amazing what acceptance he's gotten. I think, you know, I try to put myself in his mindset. You know, here he is, literally starving writer at times and publishing in the pulps and stuff, and now he's part of the Library of America, and I just wonder what his reaction would be, if he'd be proud or disgusted that it took so long, or you know, maybe thinking the mainstream liked him for all the wrong reasons. I don't know, but it's amazing that he's the stature that he's finally reached.
Yeah, and I also... looking over my notes here, I wanted to ask you how you wrote the Steampunk Trilogy back in 1995. And it's kind of just now, speaking of like gaining acceptance, it's kind of the cool thing right now. Why do you think that steampunk is like something of interest now?
Sure. Well, the book was published in 95, as you mentioned, and the individual novellas were actually, you know, a year or two older than that even. And I've been asked this question about steampunk a number of times. I've actually written, like, you know, 1,000-word responses to why the popularity of it now. So it's kind of hard to boil down to the essentials, but basically I think it's the Victorian era speaks to us on a lot of levels, stylistically, technologically, culturally, and so it just all the elements of that era are really the foundation that our current era is built on, and I think we just can't help but be drawn to that period and try to, simply to try to understand the present, we need to go backwards, I think, and look at the roots of where we come from. And that's what it provides. And also, of course, it's a great, you know, there are a lot of things from that era that we no longer enjoy, like the notion of unexplored parts of the globe and certain mysteries of science. And I think that those possess a kind of nostalgic potential that we like to explore.
Do you think that the reason that, I guess, steampunk kind of chose the Victorian era, do you think that's because that's around, like, the time of Darwin, and that's kind of when a lot of innocence was lost, I suppose?
Yeah, that's a beautiful assessment of it. I think that really speaks to a lot of what, you know, it's the cusp era, transiting from one worldview or universe view to another. So that there's a lot of tension in those eras where the, you know, the famous term paradigm shift happens. So that's a big thing. I think, though, that there have actually been similar works to steampunk that take place at different historical periods. There's a writer, he passed away a few years ago, lamentably, Charles Sheffield. He was a very good writer. And he had a book called Erasmus Magister, and it actually dealt with either Darwin's father or his grandfather. I think the grandfather. So it was like, you know, 100 years before the Victorian period, and it was these kind of steampunk adventures involving Darwin's, I'm pretty sure Erasmus Darwin was the grandfather, and he was a kind of a weird scientific guy in his own right. So Sheffield thought, let's, if we're going to explore some roots, let's go back even further.
I can verify that Erasmus Darwin was Darwin's grandfather, and he was also an evolutionist with a different kind of evolutionary theory, more similar to Lamarck's. And he was a pioneer, like an intellectual pioneer, a philosophical pioneer, a cutting edge physician. Erasmus Darwin was almost as much of a giant as his grandson.
Yeah, beautiful. Thanks, Enrique. That's that fleshes out my vague memories of the book, which came out probably, I don't know, 20 years ago. But you can see that you can take these tropes of steampunk and transport them to other eras quite fruitfully. I keep people are probably sick of hearing me talk about this, but I want to write a kind of steampunk book about Bishop Berkeley, the philosopher who was, had that great philosophical system about how perception influences reality. And I think there's probably a nice substantial book there to be written. But the research is kind of daunting because you have to do these historical things right, you have to really do your research on the era. And he was friends, Bishop Berkeley, with Jonathan Swift, and so you'd want to read up all about Swift if he was going to figure into the story. So the research is kind of daunting, which is why I keep putting it off.
How long did it take you to do the research for Steampunk Trilogy? Because you have a lot of that in there where you're constantly referencing other historical figures kind of like in a reimagined way, but you can still... obvious that you did a bunch of research.
Well, it wasn't, the great thing about science fiction, one of the great things was mentioned by Samuel Delaney, who said, to write science fiction, you don't have to be an expert, you just have to know how to sound like one. So that's very helpful. That's a very helpful trick of science fiction. The research for those, like I say, they were written separately, over a longish period of time, so I don't remember the research being too daunting. I'd read two or three books for each novella. So however long that took, two or three nonfiction books, and they were written prior to the real spread of the internet. I mean, I vaguely recall having email when those appeared, but there was certainly no Wikipedia, no Google, so it was a much different landscape for research when those were written. And I think it could be streamlined a bit nowadays.
I really liked the newt creature, and I really find like your female characters interesting because that's one thing I'm really skeptical about when a man writes a female character as the lead. Like, and I know that's kind of a little shitty, but
well, no, it's there are barriers to doing a good job that just come with the territory. So it is a task to be approached with a certain caution and humility. So thanks.
Yeah, and I thought you really exceeded, like, really did a great job with Carrie in A Mouthful of Tongues. She's a great female lead character.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that because, I do try, and I probably don't try often enough to push myself to create female protagonists. I should do that more often, just as a reminder that different points of view are out there.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask a quick question about Carrie? Mouthful of Tongues is the only one of your books I've been reading so far, and I'm loving it, by the way.
Thank you.
But just since we're talking about the issue of men writing women. Something that sticks out to me, just because I also read a lot of like feminist political books.
Yeah,
there's like there are definitely parts of the book that that for me are arousing, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it's a very surreal and very strange kind of book.
Yeah,
And there's just this part of the book where Carrie gets raped twice in a row. I don't want to ruin too much for the reader. And do you think that, do you ever wonder if that maybe like having these kind of rape scenes in a story that does have these arousing parts, what, how do you feel about all that kind of stuff? Like your responsibilities as a writer and the risks that, you know, I mean, all writing has some risks to it. And if you're a good writer, you're going to be provocative and you're going to be challenging people. Could you speak about some of these things with Mouthful of Tongues, especially because it's a tiny book. It's only like 180 pages, my copy. And, you know, someone could finish it in a day easily, but it's so thick with like gender politics, science, controversial issues in science, critique of society. It's definitely got that gritty cyberpunk feel. You know, could you speak to some of these kind of provocative issues you have in this book?
Sure. No, that's such a great legitimate territory to investigate. Well, you know, the whole notion of all these touchy subjects. I don't want to get into, you know, talk about political correctness and reactionary politics and things. But to me, first of all, I think you can only make a decision about a book when you turn the final page and close it and say, okay, there, you know, you can't pluck scenes out of context and say, well, this was, you know, two rape scenes in a row. How does it stand when you've closed the book? Does it, you know, were they justified by the total context of the book, the total plot and narrative arc? So I think that it's kind of hard to pick scenes out in isolation and say, well, this scene is repugnant or overdone. And you have to wait until the whole narrative arc is done. So I like to think that by the time you reach the end of A Mouthful of Tongues, you feel that the protagonist has not been mistreated, or if she has been mistreated, she's come out of it on the powerful end of the scale of justice, so to speak. So I think that on a whole, I think that's where the book ends up, is that the female protagonist is not dishonored or abused without some kind of compensation. There's that in comics, which we were talking prior to the show about Enrique, your love of comics. I don't know if you've run across the phrase "women in refrigerators." Have you seen that?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
Well, there was a notorious. Issue of Green Lantern where Green Lantern's girlfriend was slaughtered and stuffed into a refrigerator by the bad guy, and it was all very gratuitous, and it came to be, that was the name of the trope, is killing a woman character just to generate sympathy for the hero. It got to be called Women in Refrigerators, and I think there's even a blog by that name in which some female fans try to catalog all these awful, gratuitous things that happen in comics to women. And so I was very conscious of that, trying to avoid that whole women in refrigerators motif, which once you hear the phrase, you never forget it.
No, I don't think I ever will.
It was pretty awful. There was no reason really for it to happen except to make you feel sorry for poor Green Lantern, who of course survived, and he wasn't stuck in the refrigerator.
Yeah, the woman who wrote about that is actually a professional writer, and her name is Gail Simone.
Yes.
To that article, because it is an excellent article, and that's kind of where I was going with Carrie as an excellent female character, because and this kind of goes with what Enrique said about risk, because I was actually taught this book in a class,
And one of the girls that was in my class read to that, like, 40-page mark. Uh-huh. And said, that's it. I'm done. I don't care if I fail this class. I'm not reading anymore. And I felt so sorry for her because I am a horrible nerd and had read it ahead because the minute he told me it was the filthiest book he had ever taught,
yeah.
read the entire book that day. And so I pitied her for, like, giving up at that point because then she had to, like, live with that as the reality for that character. I know, oh, yeah, I'm getting kind of hippy-dippy here. But for me, getting to see her, and I hate that I am kind of giving away part of the book, but to see her come out on top, if you will, in a very, very big way is just so satisfying.
Thanks.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, it's kind of a fun revenge story, really. It's a beautiful work of prose, and it's with the whole, like, erotica. The erotica in it works,
thank you so much. I got a testimony I always cherish. There's a writer named Lee Siegel, and there's two Lee Siegels, actually. One guy's a critic, and one guy's a novelist. And I'm slight friends with the novelist. We, you know, exchange about two emails every year, but we're kind of out there for each other. But in any case, Lee Siegel, the novelist, told me, I sent him a copy of Mouthful of Tongues, and he said, wow, my girlfriend and I had the best sex we've ever had after reading that book. So I'm saying, oh, come on, I can't believe that, Lee, but it was nice of you to say it anyhow. So it was, I took that as kind of some testimony that maybe I hadn't totally failed in writing a useful piece of erotica. But Enrique, to venture back to, you know, you mentioning all these kind of taboo or touchy subjects, obviously, you know, I could have, here's a book, it's first world versus third world, it's male versus female, it's rich versus poor, it's totalitarianism versus anarchy. So obviously all those, if you're going to, when you reel off the subjects like that, you realize right away that the author had to have, I could have just written some kind of erotic novel set in suburbia with, you know, the wives of dentists, to use that cliche. But instead, I deliberately chose to insert all these kind of taboo or controversial subjects just to see how, you know, if the eroticism could be kind of sort of a thread that would tie them together, or at least, you know, provide a playing field, so to speak, in which they could be examined. So my intention was, you know, to bring these things out to the foreground. And I don't know if I succeeded in balancing the different factors well enough.
Well, one of the things that makes it also interesting is that you kind of reframe sex, because this character Carrie, at the risk of giving away too much, but to me this is like, if I was going to sell your book, this would be the first thing I would tell people, is that the character Carrie, she gets infused with this creature that's like a creature made entirely of stem cells.
Yes.
And then from that, she attains this kind of like constant amorphism, where she plays with her physiology in a way that I have a neuroscience degree. So, you know, when I'm impressed with a writer playing with physiology, it's not a small statement.
Thanks.
I would compare this to the Bene Gesserit in Dune.
Yep.
or the Nolaniac in Clive Barker's Imagic. I mean, like, the way that this character exists in a sexual way in the story, and it's so central, it's like you question your own, like, how much of a role does your own physiology play in your sexual experiences, and what would turn you on, or what could turn you on, because this creature, like it's, we don't have, I don't think, anything we could call a normal sex scene with Carrie, even before her transformation.
Right. Well, you know, part of my prior to the show, I mentioned that one of the inspirations for this book was Chip Delaney's Tides of Lust, which is a novel I kind of imprinted on when I was about 18 years old. And it was subsequently reprinted under his preferred title, Equinox. So readers who are looking for this book can look for either Tides of Lust or Equinox. It's the same book with one minor revision, which I'll mention in a minute. But Tides of Lust was one of my inspirations, but also the erotica of Philip Jose Farmer, which I don't know if you guys know, the erotic SF, Image of the Beast, and A Feast Unknown. Those are some remarkable books that he wrote back at the end of the 60s, early 70s. And those were just totally instrumental. And he does some of the things that that I tried to do. But I also tried to ramp up what he did then, because, I mean, that's the famous motto of fiction writers is you, as Hemingway said, you have to beat a dead man at his game. You should always be trying to take it up to the next level. So I tried to do that in Mouthful of Tongues. But you talk about taboo sexuality. The reason to get back to Chip Delaney's book, Tides of Lust, when he reprinted it about 20 or 30 years later as Equinox, the whole attitude towards underage sex had changed. And when Tides of Lust came out in like 68 or 69, the protagonists were adolescents. Several of the protagonists were, you know, like young teens having sex. And he realized when he reprinted the book as Equinox, that this would just freak people out. So he arbitrarily added 100 years to the stated age of every character. And so what happened was, instead of a 14-year-old having sex with a 30-year-old, it was a 114-year-old having sex with a 130-year-old person. And he just said, that's my, and he did it. It's totally absurd when you think about it, but that was him kind of thumbing his nose at the whole notion of people looking down on this book that had once been acceptable, but now was somehow taboo just by the passage of time and the changing of mores.
Well, I think it's fair to say, like, all really good classic erotica has, like, taboo elements. You know, I don't think you can have good erotica and not have something offensive in it.
I'm so novice at erotica. All I've ever read is Pauline Réger's Story of O.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've read, like, one Anais Nin erotica story.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading like the Anne Rice beauty book, which I'm starting to get bored with. No disrespect. Yeah. I like Mouthful of Tongues a lot more than I like the beauty.
I should mention a name, and that's a friend of mine, Cecilia Tan, who runs a small press called Circlet Press, which specializes in SF and fantasy erotica. And
great.
So anyone interested in the field should check out Circlet Press. And Cecilia's a fine writer herself, and so she puts out some of her own fiction, but also a lot of work by other people.
Yeah, well, I think it was a good thing that you did, improving that science fiction erotica is not...
not a contradiction in terms. Another book, which I think, Enrique, I think you would totally glom onto this one because it's full of biological weirdness, is Evolution's Darling by Scott Westerfeld.
I already love the title.
Yeah. Now, Scott Westerfeld has a very interesting career. He started out writing three or four, or maybe even six, like adult SF books, and then he hit it big with in the YA field. He's the author of those books, Uglies, and it's a best-selling YA trilogy that he's done. So he does mostly YA stuff these days, and his more mature stuff is kind of overlooked. So, but track down Evolution's Darling. I don't think you'll be disappointed.
Good, I'll do that. I'm really, really am loving Mouthful of Tongues. This was And as we told you before the interview, Dionysus is her favorite book. And that was a bold statement. She's influenced my reading list for many years.
Well, you guys are too kind. I just wrote, I have a story coming out in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And when I titled the story, it doesn't really have any connection with the novel, but I realize it sounds like it should. It's called A Pocket Full of Faces. And I said, and then somebody brought that up to me. They said, oh, this must be a sequel to A Mouthful of Tongues. And I said, oh, no, it's not, but it should have been. But I used the title inadvertently on something unrelated, although, as you might guess, there's a lot of bioengineering in the story. Guys, I'm enjoying the desert island encounter here. It's,
We researched you quite a bit. It's just it was like there was no end of branches. I read one of your science journalism articles that you did about drug delivery.
Well, that's just kind of paying the bills. Although I tried,
but I'm a connoisseur of that kind of stuff, so I really got a lot out of it. And it also for me it lends credibility to your sci-fi writing.
Well, it's. You know, I'm an amateur journalist, but I do try to do a good job at it.
I'll go ahead and get the next question then, because this is something. This is kind of a soapbox of mine. How do you important do you feel plausibility is in sci-fi plots? Something that I find, you know, just to give you my own bias, though I know that authors don't always agree with me, is that. If I knew that when you wrote what you wrote, it was possible, according to what we knew about science. I feel this is famously true with Philip K. Dick novels. Like, people have said that Philip K. Dick was more often than not prescient. People also say this a lot about H.G. Wells. And I get that, like, your story for Mouthful of Tongues, I find myself thinking, okay, you know, what would happen? Could we make a stem cell creature? Would it infuse with a human being? You know, just could it be possible at all? How important do you think that is? And if you do think it's important, how do you work with that with steampunk?
Well, Gregory Benford, trained physicist and very good SF writer, uses the analogy that, you know, if you start to violate plausibility, it's like playing tennis without a net. That's his famous saying about the kind of SF that he regards as cheating. And so I think if you hope to do a certain kind of science fiction, you really need to establish plausibility, and at least you have to carry it for the duration of the story. You know, somebody might finish the story and begin to have some doubts about whether it could all such thing is plausible. But I think if you make stories have their own interior logic and consistency and heft. So I think sometimes you can take a premise that is kind of far out and sell it well enough and establish the inner consistency of that narrative well enough that it does seem, you know, very plausible and very real. I'm thinking Jeffrey Ford, another excellent writer. He's not by any means known as a hard SF writer. His stories are more surreal or slipstream or fantastical. But his first trilogy, one of the books is called The Physiognomy, and I forget what the other two are. But his first trilogy is a very bizarre, surreal world. Almost kind of like Gene Wolfe's Shadow of the Torturer books, but when you read it, you believe in the society he's created, that it could cohere and that things would function precisely as he outlines them. So I think that's kind of an example of a series that is not necessarily scientifically plausible, but it has such an overarching reality just by the strength of his vision and the way he brings it across that it almost reads like science fiction because it's a depiction of a culture. You know, it's kind of that Ursula Le Guin or Jack Vance kind of science fiction where you build this weird culture from the ground up and make it so forceful that it becomes science fiction in a way.
Well, for me personally, I prefer the stories that don't belabor the science, that don't have to, like, come up with a whole, like, system. I don't know. I'm a lazy reader. I get bored, you know? The more jargony, the more, like, exact it is, the more I just kind of check out, you know?
Right. So, well, sorry. Go ahead, Diana.
So, but when something has strong enough prose, like, or if it has a good enough story, or if I'm, like I said, like, if the atmosphere is right for me, then if they put in that stuff that's actual, like, good, solid science, well, then it's just kind of like icing on the cake for me. Like I like Greg Bear because he gets me in that atmosphere and then, like, teaches me something, you know?
Yes.
But I, for me personally, the science fiction I feel that is most successful is what I guess you would call soft science fiction, which I don't like that. I don't know. I don't really approve of that label.
I don't even like the term soft science for, like, social sciences, but that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, really. Yeah, and it seems to get, like, applied towards women a lot, you know. So I find it distasteful. And plus, you know, all those connotations with soft, like it's not good or it's somehow...
it's lesser.
Yeah. I find that really irritating, but that's just me personally. But you know, do you feel like your science fiction writing is, like, prophetic? Like, that's kind of why people still, like, well, for other reasons too, obviously, but, like, Arthur C. Clarke, you know, had prophetic to it, you know.
Well, you know, I don't do enough of that, but I've done little bits and pieces. Like, I wrote a story called What's Up, Tiger Lily, after, you know, stealing Woody Allen's title. And it was, despite the silly title, it was actually kind of hard SF, and it was about the invention of e-paper, which is kind of, the story's kind of been superseded, because now we have, you know, there are all these different models of e-paper that are, you know, flexible display screens is another way of thinking of them. And so when I wrote this story, there was no real hardware for it yet, but I tried to, so I kind of fudged the hardware. I had this guy invented and I tossed in some seemingly plausible talk about how, you know, e-paper would work. But then, having fudged that part, I tried really hard to come up with, you know, how these flexible displays would be implemented in society and all the million and one uses that they would have and how they would change people's lives. So in that sense, you know, I'm starting to see a little bit of that story come true as e-paper gradually starts to hit the marketplace. So in that sense, I do feel that, you know, I've had one or two little tiny prophetic instances. And I think if you really sit down and apply yourself to looking at new technology and trying and seeing how old technology has been rolled out and how new technology could be rolled out, I think you can hit the mark once in a while with these predictions. But it's awfully hard to do. You can see why more people don't do it, because it's really the hardest kind of science fiction to write. And as Charles Stross, another great SF author, has mentioned, he has a new book coming out called Rule 34. And he tells on his blog how he had to, in the process of writing the book, which is set like 5 years in the future or so, he had to continually revise the what was happening, his plot, to stay one step ahead of current headlines. And so that's immense.
Isn't Rule 34 Just to kind of, like, just because it's, I'm curious, isn't Rule 34 like a cyber slang kind of thing on the web? Or
yes.
If it exists, porn's been made of it?
Yes, exactly. That's what he's referencing. So I have no idea of the exact plot, but I think it's probably tangential, at least to our current conversation here. Yeah, Rule 34, he just is coming out, I think, this year at some point.
That's a title that makes me want to buy that book already.
Yep. Yeah, well, he's an excellent book. I'm disappointed because everything of his is just top-notch. But he talks on his blog about, you know, if you're writing this stuff set, you know, 2, 3, 5 years ahead, it's so hard to stay ahead of the curve with the nature of how, you know, our accelerated rate of change here.
Yeah, and it's pretty much like you're guaranteeing to eventually be looked back on as quaint. You know, like, eventually that'll happen. Like, wasn't right. It recently that... they were Back to the Future. Like, wasn't that 2010 that Michael
yes. yep.
put it in the future? Yeah. So, and
where is my goddamn hoverboard?
Right.
Yeah, I know.
Well, there have been famous instances of that. Probably the most famous one is Isaac Asimov had a story appear, and the postulate of the story was that nobody had ever reached the top of Mount Everest because there was an alien base at the top. The story appeared in you know, one of the pulp magazines, like the same month that Hillary reached the top of Mount Everest. So, I mean, talk about instant obsolescence.
That must be why Asimov always said that he didn't think his stories were plausible.
Right.
But I find that Asimov was one of these authors that had a keen kind of prescient insight, just you know, regularly in his work. I have read a few Asimov novels and stories, and I still think that a lot more when the numbers come in, Asimov will have been right more often than not.
Yes.
Well, in space fiction, I think itself is so, like, inherently tricky. Like, and for me, space fiction is really hit or miss. But with people like Doris Lessing, oh my God, her aliens are amazing. And again, it's, I guess, because I like the prose and I like the, because the story is so strong.
Well, you talk about plausibility. Take one of the most famous achievements in that vein of recent years, and that's Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. Now, when you read that, you can imagine, you can say NASA could more or less just take these three books and use them as their blueprint for their Mars expedition. That's how detailed and incredibly meticulous they are. So, you know, if you, I think if you want to cite an example of plausibility in science fiction, that's probably one of the more recent striking examples, is that, you know, he just absorbed every bit of scientific data on Mars and current spaceship technology and stuff, and he turned it into, you know, just an exciting adventure tale of how humanity could possibly colonize Mars. So it can be done, but it just takes an immense amount of work.
I think one of the reasons I'm so interested in it is because, you know, you mentioned that, you know, NASA could have used it as a blueprint, and I'm sitting in the back of my mind, like, you know, from the guys that I know that are either in astronomy or studying astronomy or likely to work in astronomy for what they're studying in college, it's like, don't be surprised if they did. I've yet to meet a scientist that has not at all been influenced by science fiction.
Sure. A lot of our, you know, current landscape is because, you know, these guys in the 1940s were reading Astounding Magazine.
And still to this day, you know, it's when I was studying in school, all my friends that were studying in any kind of science degree were big science fiction fans. And now a lot of them are PhD scientists, and they're still big science fiction fans.
Yep. Well, I think one of the keenest examples of that is Freeman Dyson. Do you know his name, the physicist?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's famous in SF for, you know, Dyson spheres, that notion of this mega construction that would, you know, basically turn a whole solar system into a habitat. But he just grew up reading SF and imaginative literature of all stripes.
It's absolutely true. It's a feedback system, and I one of the goals even of this podcast is to kind of encourage that kind of a framework in society and in culture where the arts are influencing science and science is influencing the arts.
Yeah, we definitely need that. I mean, our current host of problems is not going to be solved by not talking to each other or not utilizing all our skill sets that we have. We just need to establish those lines of communication.
Well, I think the worst breakdown in communication is between people who are science or arts and then everyone else. But that might just
this is true. Selfie. Those who, yeah. Don't get me talking about sports.
Okay.
I shouldn't diss sports fan.
Well, yeah. you're in good company. I don't think Diana and I. Diana, yeah. Do you like any sports at all?
Oh my gosh, I like dance.
Beach volleyball.
Yeah, I think I like sumo wrestling and roller derby. I don't think I'm going to find very many friends in ESPN.
Yeah. I like archery, and no, I don't like sports. I played tennis because I had to play something. And I was really kind of violent and awkward. So.
Well, Dinah, why don't you take the next question?
Okay, I'm looking over my notes. Okay. You guys want to go down the comic book rabbit hole?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's a great topic. What did you want to know anything in particular? Or
yeah, she has a great question.
Okay.
You don't even know.
Well, I mean, if it's the one we've been talking about on and off for the last day.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay. Okay. So, as somebody who is a rich prose writer and can make create these images that are really vivid and these atmospheres that are vivid, how did it feel to write a comic book where someone else is responsible for your imagery?
Oh, well, I have to. That, you know, this is like a planted question because this is something I go off on all the time. I am a fan of visual artists. I have no drawing ability. I substitute collage techniques for the skills that I so drastically lack. I don't, you know, I would love to be a realist painter or artist. And so because I can't do that, I've made friends with a lot of artists. I'm friends with Todd Shore, S-C-H-O-R-I.
My very first tattoo is a Todd Shore.
Are you kidding me? Oh, that is so, he is just, I love his art. He's incredible. and I've been, if you pick up his book, Dreamland, you'll see that I did the text.
For I didn't even Dreamland. Realize that.
Yeah. And I actually have some short stories inspired by those paintings as well. But in any case, I love the visual arts, I just think those, you know, the men and women who can Miss Allen are just very very lucky people to be able to put down those marks on paper and make such great, you know, visionary works. But in any case, when I set out to do my comic book script for the Top 10 sequel, the sequel to an Alan Moore project, I got lucky enough to be assigned this artist, Jerry Ordway, who's just a brilliant, you know, he draws in kind of a updated golden age mode where it's just these big heroic characters, and yet he can do intimate stuff too, and he's just a fantastic artist, Jerry Ordway. So my best example of working with him is I had a character who was a mermaid, mm-hmm. and wanted to get around on land, and so my script says she travels in a goldfish bowl on wheels. Now, you know, that's kind of clunky, and that's what I, you know, I had this vague vision. Well, Jerry Ordway took a Segway scooter, and he put like a tulip-shaped, like a champagne glass into the body of this Segway scooter, and he filled it with water, and he stuck the mermaid in it. And so she was getting around on land with this and technically it was a goldfish bowl on wheels, but it was 1,000 times cooler than anything I had ever envisioned. And it looked beautiful on the page. And he did that over and over. He just took my descriptions, which, you know, were fairly decent and detailed, and he just amplified them incredibly. We were really on the same wavelength. So that, I think, that kind of collaboration is just, that's why I lust to do more comics in the future, is just to get that kind of level of collaboration again.
So you don't do any drawing at all? No thumbnails, no stick figures?
No, not even that Picard kind of stick figure stuff. No, I just did, my scripts were just totally verbal.
Okay, I just wanted to say that it is so incredibly ironic that you're friends with Todd Shore, because not only was my first tattoo at Todd Shore from a Todd Shore painting, Psychonaut gave me that tattoo. Oh,
that's pretty. So it's just, well, you know, it's a small universe. It's amazing that.
Also, I was passed a note here in my studio that says Ordway killed Superman. How does that make you feel? I know you said, we talked earlier that you wanted to actually.
Yeah.
Would love to write.
Well, nobody kills Superman forever. he always bounces back up. Corporate comics are something. It's such a tightrope. I mean, you can do, you know, good creative work in that arena, but on the other hand, these are not your personal playthings. You're at the behest of the corporate overlords in terms of storylines much of the time. And
I don't know if that's going to help you get
a game with DC. What can I say? But I'm not saying anything that isn't well known. So, and I'm not even saying it's a horrible practice, because look at the endurance of these, characters. They've been in, by having people who have looked out for them, there's been a certain continuity. You take something like Crazy Cat. Okay, when George Harriman died, Crazy Cat died with him. And, you know, that could be good, bad, or indifferent, but we're not going to get any more even halfway decent Crazy Cats, because it went with Harriman. And yet, you know, somebody, Siegel and Schuster, can die and Superman lives on. So it's kind of a mixed blessing, the fact that these are corporate properties. The mythos continues, but maybe not, you know, 100% of the original creator's vision.
Yeah, and there are excellent writers in the corporate world of comics, I think. Like, the Black Lantern series, I really, really enjoyed.
Yes, that was, well, yeah, and that soul, that touched a nerve, and I think that spoke to the fact that there was still some ingenuity and possibility left. It didn't have to be just kind of bland, dumbed down stuff.
Yeah, I found it to be pretty edgy for a mainstream comic. You know, you have your main bad guy, like, kills his family and kills himself. I mean, that's pretty yeah. grim.
Well, I mean,
but it made an excellent story arc.
It's not so unusual to be edgy, and sometimes it can be done. It can be overdone. If we remember the days of no insult if he's your friend, but like Rob Liefeld in Marvel Comics.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not. I don't have any personal contact with him, and his art does not turn me on.
Rob Liefeld was always trying to be edgy just for edgy's sake. Like, it's like everybody was constantly getting killed for no reason,
right.
And always had really cool outfits while they were doing it.
Right. They just got pneumonia and died or whatever.
Oh, Well, we're almost out of time. I wanted to, Roadside Bodhisattva your most recent book?
It's my most recent novel, but it's been superseded by a new book from PS Publishing. I can tell you briefly about both of them. Roadside Bodhisattva is another example of me totally losing my current audience and probably failing to attain a new one because it's utterly naturalistic and mimetic, as we say in the trade here. It's there's not an ounce of fantasy or surrealism or absurdity or anything, and it's just a straight novel about a young boy who runs away from home and what happens to him. And I did it as, you know, as a test of whether I could write such a thing. And I think I did a good job, but I have been telling people it always felt like trying to play tennis with one hand tied behind your back. You know, when the plot bogged down, there was no chance to interject a spaceship or a ghost or a dragon or anything. It was just, you know, where do I take his mundane life at this point? So that's what Roadside Bodhisattva is. It's a straight naturalistic novel about a young boy's adventures on the road. But then to just out this month is A Princess of the Linear City, which is a sequel to my novella, A Year in the Linear City. And just to totally whip people's heads around, it's the exact opposite. It's utterly bizarre and fantastic and strange. So that's how we do it.
Well, Paul, we really want to thank you for your time and for writing your wonderful books. And you know, we hope to keep in touch and...
I'm sure this will be the start of a long and happy communication. You guys have just been marvelous to have me on the show.
Well, thank you. The honor is all ours.
This has been the Mindcore Podcast featuring Diana Sparks and Psychonaut, interviewing on this episode Paul DeFilippo, all music used by artists with permission. Check the show notes for the artists and their music.